This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, another exit interview. Now 100 MPs have announced they're standing down at the next election. Today we bring you number 19 in the exit interviews. Conservative MP Henry Smith lifts the lid on Parliament and delivers his verdict on the various Tory leaders who've been his boss over the years. Thank you to all of you who've been in touch, actually, about the series and how much you've been enjoying it. If you want to catch up, you can search for Exit Interviews wherever you're listening to this. Before that, as ever, we'll bring you the columnists Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on why Britain even needs to get involved in the Middle East. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, it's been quite the weekend for news, all the focus moving away from Angela Rayner's second home to World War III. So let's get the take on all of that from today's columnists.
The Columnists with Libby Rachie, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
And we are joined in the studio by Rachel Sylvester. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Matt.
And is Libby with us? Libby, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Yep,
fabulous. Good to have you with us. We obviously need to talk about the slightly worrying prospect of the early skirmishes of World War III over the weekend. You've got the head of the UN warning the Middle East is on the brink following Iran's attack on Israel, in response for Israel's apparent attack on an Iranian embassy. The world's just sort of sitting and waiting to see how Israel will retaliate. What do you think, first of all, of the question? I spoke to Tom Fletcher, the former ambassador to Lebanon, a bit earlier. Rachel, this question, this comes up all the time. Listeners messaging in and saying, why is Britain getting involved?
Yeah, you're Politics Without the Boring Bits, not Politics Without the Scary Bits, Matt, aren't you? I think there's a difference in this case between defensive and offensive action, and that is what Britain has been helping Israel with, defending from this really unprecedented state-on-state attack from Iran, which is a real escalation of what's happened previously. So I think that is how the government would explain the involvement at this stage. But I think, as David Cameron's made pretty clear, that Britain would be reluctant to get involved in a more offensive intervention.
Do you think, Libby, they should be doing more of that explaining?
Yes, I like the Lord Cameron's head as well as heart plea to Israel, though it's not just heart, it's sort of angry gut feeling and enmity and fear and offence. And I mean, all the world can really do is pray that Israel finds a way to be the good man in the fight. Because I think what's happening in Gaza and then the attack on the Iranian soil has shaken the faith of its friends and supporters in America and in much of Europe, though not all Europe. And I just think that you know, you just got clench and hope that Israel finds a way to respond in a way which doesn't make things worse.
I mean, I suppose there's this risk, because clearly domestically, Benjamin Netanyahu is not as popular as he was. And so he seems to have got slightly stuck in this doom loop of thinking he can revive his popularity by bombing the hell out of Gaza. You know, it's just a few more. You know, and actually the weird thing is, it's sort of, the opposition to what he's doing seems to be rising, and yet his response is to do more and more of it. And then you've got this situation with Iran as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? All around the world, domestic politics is interacting with the kind of international politics. You know, you see that in America, you see that in Israel, you see that here too, to some extent. But I think Libby's right. We just have to hope that the head wins out over the heart and the gut, and that there is a sense of actually that it would be very easy for this to escalate through a series of miscalculations on both sides. I think, you know, what Iran did over the weekend reinforced the support for Israel among America and European allies. And that had been not wavering in fundamental terms, but there had been growing concerns about the way in which Netanyahu has been behaving in Gaza. But that, in a way, what Iran did sort of brought the Israel's allies back behind Netanyahu, but it's conditional.
Yeah.
And I think he's got to realise that actually, and he probably doesn't have the strength to go it alone. You know, he didn't go it alone this weekend.
Actually the thing. You know, there were so many different ways of interpreting it. On one hand, you've got David Cameron and Joe Biden saying, bank the win. You know, it didn't work. You know, the one child injured, but aside from that, no major damage caused. Bank the win. You know, the flip side is it actually demonstrates that Israel required the support of America, France and Britain to stop it working. Libby, because you brought up David Cameron, I'm quite interested in this question of how this sort of plays out. Because once again, David Cameron, he was on Times Radio this morning and doing the media round, you know, confirming his reputation as the best communicator in the government. Whatever you think of what he's actually saying. And I just wanted to play you a couple of clips. So this was David Cameron on Times Radio today.
This is a double defeat for Iran. Not only was their attack an almost total failure, but also the rest of the world can now see what a malign influence they are in the region and understand their true nature. And so I think it is right for Israel not to escalate. But obviously they're a sovereign, independent country and they'll make their own decision.
And then contrast that with Rishi Sunak speaking yesterday.
This was a dangerous and unnecessary escalation, which I've condemned in the strongest terms. Thanks to an international coordinated effort, which the United Kingdom participated in, almost all of these missiles were intercepted, saving lives not just in Israel, but in neighbouring countries like Jordan as well.
Libby, is it a problem that Rishi Sunak does seem to have subcontracted foreign policy to David Cameron far more than any previous prime minister I can really think of?
Yeah, well, it may not be a bad thing. I mean, I didn't think Cameron was a particularly good prime minister, but I think he is possibly far better as a foreign secretary. And either you trust your foreign secretary or you don't. And Sunak has quite a lot of battles to fight back home. And I mean, I can think of plenty of other people he might have made foreign secretary, which feels like a complete horror story. So Cameron, I think, is you know, I mean, I don't mind this. I think what Cameron's saying seems to me calm and reasonable and sensible, and that is what the world needs leaders and their representatives to say just now.
But there's a question of whether or not David Cameron is, you know, rises all small boats, you know, tide bringing. Is he helping Rishi Sunak, or is he what he actually doing, highlighting that he's a bit unsubstantial on the world stage?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because normally prime ministers become more and more international the longer they go on, because they tire of domestic politics. But Rishi Sunak's done the opposite. But what I thought is really interesting listening to those two clips from them is the reason that I think Cameron is such a good political communicator is because he takes on the argument from his potential critics. So, for example, in this case, he said to Israel, I can understand they're a sovereign nation. They may want to wreak revenge, but actually I'd urge, you know, head, not heart. And Blair does the same. The best political communicators, they don't just, you know, bombard, you know, with their opinion and say, this is the truth, like it or loathe it. They take on the argument that the other side might make and they explain why actually they think they're right. And it takes a confidence actually to do that. And I wonder whether a former prime minister may find that easier than a current one.
But I suppose there's also sometimes something where you've actually thought about it. This is actually, rather than being given a line to take.
Yeah.
There's always a slight sense with Rishi Sunak and some of the others. They're so desperate not to upset anyone, whether it's international or domestic.
Well,
there's a line to take and we're going to hold that and we're going to repeat it again and again.
Exactly. It's an argument rather than just a line.
And there's a sort of self-confidence about that. Well, it'll be interesting to see how all of that pans out. And Rishi Sunak is making a common statement on the topic later today, Monday. So we'll see what he's got to say about that. Let's move away from that. Let's come back closer to home. Libby, you've written your column today on, amongst other things, this extraordinary story of being accused of age discrimination in the workplace if you offer an older person a chair.
Well, yes, it was one case and it wasn't the only thing. But I mean, it is interesting that age discrimination is massively increasing in these employment tribunals, and that the compensation is uncapped. Somebody got 200,000 for being thrown out for not being able to work a computer because she was 89 at one stage. I just wanted, as a lifelong 50-year freelancer, you know, who is no danger to anybody, you know, I can be thrown out instantly of every job that I do or every commission that I take. But I have been close to two work employment disputes heading towards tribunals, and I've been a witness at one tribunal, and the whole process seems to me absolutely geologically slow and intricate and labyrinthine, absolutely, desperate and not good for employers on the whole and not good for employees on the whole. And I think it needs smoothing out. So as a complete outsider and not a lawyer, I thought I would chuck all that stuff together. And of course, below the line, it's all boiling up.
It's a good point you make, though, Libby, because quite often with these sort of employment tribunal stories, and I don't know, not this particular one, I'm not commenting on that one, but in other stories, it's always sort of person was sacked because they didn't offer someone a cup of tea, and then halfway through it turns out they also embezzled loads of money and threatened someone with a machete.
Yes, but the point is, part of the problem is that the law seems to have to take, because of all the changes in the employment law we've had over the years, the law is having to talk a lot about feelings and to assess money on terms of people's feelings in some of these cases, and I don't think lawyers should have anything to do with feelings. You know, I think the two things do not go together. And I think that some of the things for hurt and harmed feelings and emotions are absolutely lethal, and we shouldn't be playing with it.
It's interesting, this point about the person who offered a seat. Maybe you need a sort of baby on board version for an older person. I don't mind being offered a seat. But there's an interesting point here about why being a good employer is actually good for the bottom line rather than just good for the employees. So I was speaking to James Timpson recently, who runs, the key cutting cobblers.
Yeah.
And they make a point of hiring ex-offenders, ironically, given that they have key cutting services. But they see it as a noble thing to do. You know, you're giving someone a chance, you're helping the kind of rehabilitation, reducing reoffending. But they say actually it's good for their company because the people who come through that route are very loyal employees. They work incredibly hard. They're very diligent. They're keen to make a go of it. So the sort of, sometimes it's seen as being a good employer or giving people employment rights is sort of bad for your profits. Actually, I think the reverse is the case. If you're a good employer, it helps your profits.
I suppose the thing is that the idea of a good employer is in the eye of the beholder.
A good employer is a good manager. So many of the cases you read about, and I read about dozens and dozens over the weekend, so many of the discrimination ones, especially the ones where one, worker has felt discriminated against by other workers or had their feelings hurt or racial slurs implied by other workers, is because the management is lousy, because they don't know what's going on in their own workplace, because they don't, they're not out there, in there, in among the workforce, taking an actual interest. You know, they treat people as units. And therefore, if one of the units suddenly says something offensive to another unit, and then the other unit, the whole thing goes all the way up to a tribunal, masses of time, months, money is wasted on this. And I just think a lot of it is in really poor management. Timpsons are great managers because they care about their workforce. Lots of other companies I could name are great because they care about their workforce. I used to go in and out of various offices doing this sort of lectury thing that I did. And you could tell the second you walked in almost whether this was an awful place where you'd hate to work or a really good place where it would be good to work. You know, that matters.
Now, do you want to see political ads on your TV? Guardian reported today that the ITV is considering taking paid ads from political parties for the first time thanks to a loophole in broadcasting law. Well, let's bring in Chris Banatvala, who is Ofcom's founding director of Standards, who can hopefully explain why. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So, ever since commercial TV began, what, back in the 1950s, political parties haven't been able to buy ads on TV. What is this loophole that might see that change in 2024?
Yes, you're right. Since the 1954 Television Act, political ads have been banned on all television channels. But obviously, since the beginning of this century, we've had internet services, both streaming, but also sort of Facebook and YouTube. And those that ban, because of the law, has not been applied to them. So effectively, TV adverts for political parties could be transmitted on, or sort of can be available on, YouTube, Facebook, etc. However, obviously, since about 2008, streaming services are much more popular, and the ban is not currently applied to those services because they're delivered on the internet. So there is, in inverted commas, a loophole, but a loophole that we've always known about. Up to this point, streamers have not wanted, for various reasons, probably because of their reputation, wanted to take political ads. But of course, you know, with the money that's available potentially for this now, and also the fact that advertising is on a downward trajectory, perhaps they want to take these ads.
Well, does this fill you with joy, Rachel? You'll be there watching something on ITVX.
No, definitely not. It would be appalling. And I think if there is a rule that you shouldn't have ads on television, that's got to apply to streaming services, where many people now watch television through those streaming services. I don't know what the proportion is, but I can't imagine that many people actually sit down and watch television according to the timetable that's in the Radio Times or whatever. But I actually think it might backfire for the political parties, because, you know, you're in the middle of watching Love Island or whatever, and suddenly up pops some dreadful politician trying to lecture you about the economy or whatever. It's not. I don't think it's going to win them many votes. And the danger from their point of view is it just irritates people. But from the broadcaster's point of view, I think there is a point of principle here that either it applies to all broadcasting or it applies to none.
I think what's really interesting about this is that we currently have a media bill going through the Lords and back to the Commons soon, which specifically requires these streaming services, Netflix, Amazon's, Disney's, to start complying with TV-like standards. It's the first time this has ever applied. And also in standards such as impartiality. However, they are not going to apply political advertising. So it does seem to be rather inconsistent here. And the government have to decide whether or not they want streamers to comply with TV-like standards or not. And it's a bit of a mixture at the moment. It's a bit of confusion.
Yeah, and actually, it seems like at the moment, individual streamers are making their own decisions. Channel 4 says it will continue to apply its political advert ban to its streaming services. Sky says it won't run them on Now TV. And Netflix and Amazon Prime both have global bans on political adverts. But ITV, and also, you know, the advertising world is changing, Libby. It's harder for, you know, a broadcast like ITV to make money. So if there is the offer of political parties with deep pockets, they might be tempted to take it.
If I start getting Coronation Street interrupted by political party broadcasts, I shall be very, very distressed. But I think we should also mention that there was a rule change only announced last year that the amount that national political parties can spend on a general election has gone up from 19.5 million in 2019 to 35 million. It's nearly doubled. The money's got to go somewhere. They are going to spend it on streaming and digital ads. It's an absolute nightmare. It's far too much money, far too high. It is going to make people angrier and more sort of uncooperative about politics even than they are now. I think it needs sorting out.
There's another interesting point, isn't there, that under the radar advertising that's going on, very targeted to people through Facebook, Instagram, all these social media sites as well, and I assume YouTube, that there are very kind of almost micro targeting ads that are becoming increasingly powerful and prevalent.
And
for
much
the
harder to keep tabs on. Are they accurate and all that sort of thing? Chris, what
I think also it's going to be very difficult for the government to continue a ban on TV political advertising if it allows streamers to go this way. It was only in 2013 that this all went all the way up to the European Court. And they bat marginally the government's position on banning political advertising on TV. Now, if you allow streamers, which are now very like television channels, to allow it, it's going to undermine the whole provision. And we will have political advertising, whether you like it or not, on television. There's an argument that may be the right thing, but you have to think very carefully about and having a full sort of, you know, discussion about this.
And probably not ahead of this coming election. Chris, what's the situation with radio? Because obviously there's a difference if you're listening on a DAB radio versus, does it count as streaming as if it's on a smart speaker or an app?
So basically, radio, if it's DAB or terrestrial or whatever, have to comply with the same rules as television with regard to political advertising. Only when it goes online, and it's purely online, do these rules not apply. There's a complete division between online and either, you know, satellite, DAB, terrestrial, etc., i.e. traditional broadcasting. But as I've said, the government are bringing in TV-like regulation to streamers, to your Netflix, to your Amazons, to your Disneys, to all that lot.
And so why do you think they haven't included the political advertising? Is it an oversight or is that deliberate, do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Rachel. I think they realised that they've done this, and the Media Act is not about, or sorry, the Media Bill is not about advertising. It's about editorial standards. So they've sort of allowed it. They're aware of it. They've sort of implied that they will think about it, but nothing's happened.
So there could be quite a simple amendment that would clarify it.
If that's really what
they're saying. You just go to the Communications Act, Section 321, and say this applies to streamers.
And so, Chris, finally, what would be your, having worked in standards at Ofcom, what would be your advice to ITV? Do you think they should do this?
I think they've got to be very, very careful with this. I think political advertising is so wrapped up with impartiality. So, you know, one of the reasons why political advertising is not allowed on TV and radio is because of the commitment to impartiality. If you start giving, inverted commas, loads of airtime to people who've got lots of money, so you give it to either the Conservative or the Labour Party and not the Lib Dems, you're then skewing the airtime that you're giving. I know it's not your airtime because it's advertising, but you're skewing the overall service. So it really undermines the impartiality framework as well. So you've got to be really careful here. It's not just a matter of saying, oh, yes, we'll allow this. It's gone. I think there is a potential problem here. And if the rules that require streamers to comply with impartiality come in and they're allowed to particularly advertise, how does that work?
It's really interesting, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us. There's Chris Bannatvala, who was the Director of Standards at Ofcom, on that news that ITV could take paid ads from political parties. Libby Purvis, Rachel Sylvester, lovely to see you. Thanks so much for joining us. And you can read them in The Times every day, of course, with your Times subscription. Just go to thetimes.co.uk. And with your subscription, you can link up with your Apple subscription and you get a bonus episode of the podcast every weekend. Up next, it's another exit interview.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crossroads. Brass Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
We've already said
Henry Edward Miller Smith is leaving us soon.
Goodbye.
Born in 1969, he's been the MP for Crawley since 2010, when he was elected at the third attempt, one of dozens of MPs quitting at the next election. In his exit interview, he reflects on nearly 15 years in Parliament, including getting abuse online.
I had people publish where my children go to school on websites.
Why Parliament isn't the easiest office to work in.
It's still a weird place. It's not the real world. Yes, that does have an effect on you.
And he delivers his verdict on his former bosses, including David Cameron.
Aplomb.
Boris Johnson.
He's a superstar.
And Liz Truss.
She came out of the starting blocks very quickly and then tripped over on herself.
Henry Smith, thank you for joining us for your exit interview. A chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. Classic first exit interview question then. Why are you leaving?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I've been a member of Parliament for now 14 years. Prior to that, I was leader of West Sussex County Council for 7 years, and I've been a councillor since 1997. And, you know, I'm going to be 55 in a few weeks' time, and I want another challenge, another opportunity in my life, another career. But also, you know, I do feel a little bit disillusioned. 4.5 years ago, we were elected, or my party, the Conservatives, were elected with an 80-seat majority, as it was then. And, yeah, I appreciate we've had a global pandemic and we've had war in Europe, but I do think there's a lot more we could have done to be bolder, and there were a lot of missed opportunities. So I feel personally it's time to move on, but I suppose I've lost that zest that you need if you're going to be in politics and public life to really promote the principles that you believe in.
You stood in Crawley in 2001 and 2005 before finally being elected in 2010. Is it hard to walk away when you spent basically a quarter of a century, half your life you've spent either trying to get elected or then being the MP?
Well, and in actual fact, in 2005, I lost by 37 votes, which was the closest result in the country, that general election. Yes, I've invested a lot of my time and energy into politics, into public office in various different kinds. Politics is in my blood. I'm not going to sort of suddenly have a disinterest in it going forward. But I think you really need to have the energy to be able to fight an election campaign, and also the energy to properly represent people. And I feel that when you get the feeling that it's time to move on, you should probably listen to yourself and pick the moment of your departure, perhaps rather than other people picking that for you. So I think a combination of things with mixed emotions means that now's the time to move on. But, you know, proud of some of the achievements that I've been able to realise both in local government and in Parliament.
Let me be cynical for a moment, because it's been the case with several of your colleagues who've come in for this. You've got a majority of, what, just over 8,000. If we look at the polls, if we look at what's happening in by-elections, is there part of this that actually you just can't be, you can't face traipsing around campaigning again? It looks like the Tories are going to lose that seat.
That's a factor, undoubtedly, that if you feel that it's going to be an uphill struggle to retain your seat, then that is a demotivating factor. Of course it is. I think that's human nature. But I think more so, I've reached a point in my life when I want to look for other opportunities and do new things. But it just feels like a natural moment. And it's something that I've been considering actually for about the last two and a half years now is probably a time to make a change. The polls are challenging, but, you know, never say never. A week's a long time in politics, and I suspect we've got about 6 months to go. Who knows what could happen in that time?
You talked about losing slightly the zest for it all, the enthusiasm for it all. I mean, you must have had some zest to go out campaigning as a Conservative in 2001. You know, William Hague leading you into that didn't go terribly well. 2005, again, you got close. Michael Howard didn't particularly. What does it say then about Rishi Sunak that he's the one, that his leadership, the current position of the Conservative Party, is the one that you've lost the faith with?
Well, I think we have had a series of unforced errors during this Parliament. There have been a number of mistakes that, quite frankly, were made that shouldn't have been made, and there's been quite a series of them in quick succession, which, you know, does lead to some despondency that, you know, the team that you have worked so hard for perhaps aren't delivering, and I take my part in that as a team. There have been far too many mistakes made, and like I said, I feel that really the political advantage that the party achieved in December 2019 under Boris Johnson has been squandered. And that, again, is a big factor for me deciding that actually it's far more productive in my life to do something different.
It's interesting because you've spent clearly most of your adult life in Conservative politics one sort or another. You said you were leader of the council and then MP. You've never been a minister. Do you think that party leadership takes for granted the foot soldiers, whether that's MPs on the back benches or councillors across the country?
I think that's true of all parties in Parliament. I think that there is a danger that you can lose touch with the grassroots, the people who do go out several times a week in many instances, knocking on doors. And that's always a challenging thing in terms of the response you sometimes will get in more challenging areas and cold weather and getting rained on and all the rest of it. Those are, as you say, the foot soldiers, the people who really support parties. They attend the social events, they fundraise locally. And I think whenever a party leadership starts to drift away from that grassroots, then that's bad news. I think we've seen that in both Labour and Conservative governments throughout recent history.
Given it, because those seem to be braced for a pretty rough set of local elections in May, what's that like when you are a foot soldier, a councillor, either, you know, hanging on to your seat or otherwise, then being asked to go out and campaign a few months later for the very people who've probably just cost you your seat?
Well, that is a challenge. But what I have always been blessed with is coming across really dedicated people in my local Conservative Association, people who are knocking on doors and delivering leaflets and trying to get councillors elected and the Member of Parliament elected because they believe in the principles of the party. Now, obviously, that's a lot more challenging when all of the headlines and the opinion polls are telling you that it's probably going to be a difficult set of local elections and I'm sure a difficult general election campaign as well.
You talked about some of the mistakes that have been made. You were a staunch supporter of Brexit. Do you think that the government has done enough to take advantage of what you saw as being the opportunities of Brexit?
No, and that's one of the reasons why I think we've actually squandered some of the freedoms that we have since leaving the European Union. You know, whether you agree with our leaving the European Union or not, we did, and we should have been, I think, a lot more bold in realising those freedoms. So just one, for example, we don't have to have a VAT regime for after we've left the European Union. We could have a local sales tax system. That's just one example of a way that we could have been much more bold in terms of quite a different vision. And I do think there has been some, shall we say, establishment and institutional drag on realising those opportunities. Undoubtedly, COVID significantly got in the way of that, both in terms of the restrictions that were brought in and the economic impact of that. But I do, you know, I do feel a lot more could have been done. And of course, we had those sort of torturous years from the referendum results until the December 2019 election, when many in Parliament were seeking to overturn what the people had voted for.
Yeah, that period, none of us would want to revisit that 3 years, basically.
It was actually being part of it was very stressful. Yeah. It was a really sort of anxious moment.
And actually, towards the end of that, it's almost exactly 5 years ago, we had this situation where Theresa May was slipping into the low 20s in the polls. There was a party on the right on the up, it was the Brexit Party then, now it's the Reform UK.
I think I know where you're going with
this. Around that point, you said, I won't be surprised at all if more voters turn to the Brexit Party. Nigel Farage is certainly doing a better job than Theresa May in leading. Is Nigel Farage doing a better job than Rishi Sunak now?
Well, I don't think Nigel Farage is a candidate at the moment. Maybe that will change. But I think it's always dangerous when a political party drifts away from its core principles and purpose and slightly loses its way. And I, you know, sadly feel that that's where the Conservative Party has been. So, you know, little wonder that other parties, both major parties like Labour and minor parties like Reform, are reaping the benefits of that. What I'm very struck by is, though, there is a sort of a plague on all your houses attitude with the electorate. I still speak to the electorate, knocking on doors myself in the cold and the rain still. And, you know, there's no great enthusiasm for Keir Starmer and Labour. It's just they're not the Tories. So I think, you know, there's still a lot of undecideds, and I suspect we will see quite a few stay-at-homes, certainly in the local elections, possibly in the general election as well.
If you weren't a Conservative MP, you know, you won't be in the next election, would you be tempted to vote for Reform?
No, I, as you said earlier on, you know, I've spent my life, I joined the Conservative Party when I was a teenager. I first stood for election unsuccessfully against Labour in 1996. I've seen it all before. I've seen the ups and the downs, the triumphs and the disappointments. And, you know, I believe that it is recoverable for the Conservative Party to find its principles, to find its purpose again. And so, no, I'm not sort of tempted by sort of minority parties, even though I understand why they are popular and why they have risen as a result of events.
You talked also actually in 2019, and this is something that's come up when we've been doing this series with cross-political parties, about the threats that MPs are under, and you and your family, including threats and stalking. That was back in 2019. It seems to me it's probably even got worse since then.
Sadly, I think it probably has. I mean, previously I had people publish where my children go to school on websites, sort of with an encouragement to go to that school and, you know, I don't know what, but anyway, yeah. Publishing where your children go to school is pretty horrendous. Yes, I did have a stalking incident as well. And of course, there's just the everyday common and garden abuse that you get on social media. It does seem to be that with social media, there's a degree of separation. Like some people lose their cool when they get behind the wheel. I think when there is that degree of separation, when people aren't engaging face to face, then people say some pretty vile things. And I think anyone in public life, whether it's politics or other aspects, sport or celebrity or the royal family, I think that the way that people interact on social media has been quite corrosive. I support social media in the fact that any of us can post what we're up to, what our thoughts are. That's positive. That's a greater democratization of media. But that doesn't excuse abuse. And that does wear people down. You have to have a thick skin, at the risk of sounding cliched, as a politician. But it does get you down after a while.
One of the questions we've been asking this exit interview, it was a classic sort of exit interview question, is would you recommend this job to a friend or someone you cared about?
Only under the circumstances that you were really passionate about wanting to be involved in public life and wanting to make a positive difference. I think it's quite instructive that neither of my two children, who are almost 21 and 18, they have absolutely no signs of wanting to go into politics, and I wouldn't try and dissuade them otherwise.
You haven't become a minister over during your time in the Commons. Was that deliberate? Were you ever asked? Were you offered the greasy pole at one point and you declined?
Yes, I was approached on a number of occasions, but I decided, you know, my seat has always been a marginal seat. Whoever has won my seat since it was created in 1983 has gone on to be the party of government. And, you know, I made a decision that really being a good, hopefully a good constituency MP was where I was best placed, and to pursue interests in Parliament, both constituency interests and interests I have more widely through chairing all party parliamentary groups, for example, and, you know, being able to take part in debates. Of course, if you're in the Whip's office, traditionally you can't take part in debates. And so I think that is something that really restricts your ability to be a constituency MP. And I'm very passionate about our system. I think the link where, you know, approximately a community of 100,000 people has one individual that is representing them in Parliament, and you meet your constituents on a regular basis, and you're involved in your local community, I think that's a really strong aspect and something, one of the parts of the job actually I've really enjoyed.
One of the things, it struck me that maybe if you had become a minister, animal welfare would have been quite high on your list of potential jobs. You've done a lot on calling for bans on foie gras, fur imports. You're a vegetarian. You were even endorsed by Brian May from Queen at one point for opposing badger culling. Are we still a nation of animal lovers, do you think?
I hope so, and I believe so, but sometimes I think that we slightly turn a blind eye to some of the abuse that goes on in terms of the way we treat animals, whether it's for food production or still a lot of cruelty that exists. So, yeah, animal welfare has always been a passion of mine. I got that from my late mum. She would always write to our local MP when I was growing up, pestering them on animal welfare issues. So I think it had a lasting effect. And, you know, even when I leave Parliament, it's still an area that I'm keen to try to play my part in.
I think it's fair to say you've always been quite straight talking, so maybe diplomacy wasn't a thing. In 2013, you called Vladimir Putin a tosser on social media because you were angry at that point about support for the Assad regime, but maybe you were, maybe given everything that's unfolded since, you were right, you were ahead of your time.
Well, sadly, I think I've been proved correct on that one. He's obviously an evil individual. I'll try and keep it polite this time, Matt. And clearly a very malign force. And so, yeah, I thought so at the time. And unfortunately, I've been vindicated in that.
OK, let's do some classic exit interview things. And let's go through your assess your relationship with your various bosses over the years. If you could sum up them in a word or a phrase. Let's start with David Cameron. David Cameron in a word.
Aplomb. I thought he was very dedicated and principled and quite cool under pressure. So, and I think still is now as Foreign Secretary.
He's back as Foreign Secretary.
He's back. So, yeah, aplomb in a word.
Very good. Theresa May in a word.
I think she was very dedicated. I had my differences with Theresa May. I didn't think she handled the Brexit negotiations in the way that they should have done. But I think she's a very genuine individual who cares. So I would say dedication.
What about Boris Johnson in a word?
Well, he's a superstar. He is somebody who, against the odds, became mayor of... he's somebody that has one of those rare abilities to connect with people across many different backgrounds. You know, he's known as Boris. He's not known as, you know, Mr. Johnson. And, you know, I think after perhaps the quite managerial style of Theresa May that got us sort of bogged down during the Brexit negotiations, he offered that sort of, let's say, that sort of star quality to be able to communicate to communities that traditionally the Conservative Party hadn't done very well in. But like many stars, perhaps they have some flaws, and I think he was the victim of some of those mistakes that he made. So, yeah, he does have that star quality, and I think, you know, continues to be extremely popular when you speak to people, you know, the average voter in the street.
Do you think it was partly sort of, did he let that star quality go to his head a bit? That actually, as well as being very good and popular out in the public, you do need to do the work, whether that's making an album or a film or running the country.
I think perhaps he wasn't so focused on detail, and I think that's perhaps where he got caught up with just the enormity of government, and that times, you know, many, many percentages in terms of a period of crisis which the COVID pandemic created.
Okay, so we've got aplomb, dedicated superstar. Liz Truss in a word.
Ambitious, both in a good way and a bad way. I think, you know, she's genuinely ambitious for economic growth, but she was also...
Then who isn't?
Well, I think that was really her real mission, but I think her personal ambition was the thing that undid her very quickly, because she didn't, I think, explain what her sort of reason for that budget, that infamous budget, why she was making those decisions that she was. So I think she almost, she came out of the starting blocks very quickly and then tripped over on herself, I think. So ambition in both a good and a bad way.
Finally then, Rishi Sunak in a word.
I think he's very conscientious. He's somebody that works incredibly hard from what I can see. I do think he really cares about the country and trying to make a positive difference. I think he has taken on the premiership at a time that is obviously extremely difficult for his party with everything that has happened, which doesn't really need repeating. But I think he's genuine and conscientious in his approach.
Would it make any difference to the Conservative Party's fortunes if you change leader again?
I think we would lose any credibility if we did that. It doesn't sit comfortably with me that he wasn't elected to the leadership, if I'm being absolutely honest. But I think if we were to have yet another leadership change in the Conservative Party, you know, history shows that the electorate doesn't support divided parties. Whatever the reason for that division is. And I think it's, frankly, too late for a refresh.
You talked a bit about some of your pride in your work, particularly did on local constituency and maintaining that link, and you enjoying that part of the job. Which part of the job do you enjoy the least?
I just think the long hours, you know, and it's got better, actually, during my time in Parliament, but it's still not a natural working environment. You know, today on a Monday, typically we'll go till 10:30, you know, 7:30 Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and perhaps more normal hours on Thursdays and Fridays. But one of the things I regret about being a Member of Parliament is the impact it has on family. Mm. So when I was elected in 2010, my daughter was was her seventh birthday when I was elected, and you know, my son was 4 years old, and I missed a lot of their growing up, and that is something that I regret. It is hugely stressful on family life, and anyone thinking of going into Parliament needs to stop and really think extremely carefully about that.
Is there actually something we could do with the political system? Because this has come up time and time again across parties, that it feels as if anyone in their, 30s, 40s, 50s ends up basically having to make the choice between politics representing their country, their constituency, and seeing their kids grow up. And that seems like, in a modern country, that seems an odd way to either exclude people or to make them miserable.
It's not a normal job. It's not normal hours. Now, you know, when you go into public life, there's an element of sacrifice. Mm. You know, the amount of hours that a Member of Parliament does and the level of responsibility, you know, typically isn't remunerated as it would be remunerated in many other sectors of the economy. But there is a sort of, there is a compromise you make in terms of public service, and that will have an impact on personal life. But I do think, yet Parliament could be, it's improved. You know, members of Parliament now taking young children through the voting lobbies and things like that. But it's still a weird place. It's not the real world in many ways. And yes, that does have an effect on you.
Final exit interview question. What will you do next?
Well, I don't know. I was writing my CV, actually, a couple of weekends ago.
You which and is dozens
an,
of others.
Which was an interesting experience.
How do you stand out in a market now awash with the CVs of outgoing MPs?
Well, good question. I've got a few lines of inquiry, but I'm looking for a new challenge. I'm looking for a new opportunity. Not quite sure when I'm available, but I'm looking forward to a new era in my life. And one of the things I thought to myself, I made the announcement almost exactly a year ago. I'd been thinking about it for about 18 months prior to that. But just before I made the announcement, I thought to myself, am I going to regret this in 6 months' time, in 9 months' time? And the honest answer to that is no, I've made the right decision. So I'm looking to the future with optimism.
Well, Henry Smith, thank you for joining us for your exit interview on Times Radio.
My pleasure, thank you. I don't want to see you go, but darling,
you better go now. And that was the exit interview of Conservative MP Henry Smith. And don't forget, you can search for all of the previous episodes by just searching for the exit interviews wherever you're listening to this. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.